Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Globe Gazette for November 9th, 2021. I am your reader, Peter Welch. Heritage Park hosts 4 days of filming. Silent Night in Algona, a fall 2022 release, will feature Farmhouse. Heritage Park in Forest City is dedicated to the preservation of America's rural heritage. That and three World War II prison barracks from Algona, and what first lured Silent Night in Algona, movie producers and directors and now actors and crew who descended on Heritage Park for 4 days of filming, October 31st through November 3rd. But it is the 1940s farmhouse that is a focus of filming at the park. It serves as the Teats farming family home for the movie. I had no idea what Heritage Park entailed when I was talking to Dave Kingland for this. Director Tony Hornus said, "We could not believe what this park is. We got here and it was like the dining room table was already set for Thanksgiving." The story unfolds between October and Christmas Eve 1944 and will be in theaters and on streaming platforms by late fall 2022. A private meeting was held at Heritage Park on August 21st, which Hornus and others from Michigan-based Collective Development Incorporated. Hornus estimated that the crew members of 50 people and the cast of 45 people. The trade-off is we can't really shoot too much of the exterior, Hornus said. There are a lot of other buildings we have to shoot around. We've had to shoot tight. Hornus said that the Rudy Teets character has a bad back and can't do all of the farm work. He said that we need those guys, German POWs. They're not all Nazis, and a lot of them are just like us, Hornus said. On October 31st, a mailbox scene was filmed in which young Don Teets is concerned about the German prisoner's presence when he encounters his father, Rudy. Kingland is executive director of the Armed Forces Historical Center of North Iowa Museum, being located in one of the barracks. He said that the house and its decor are authentic 1940s era. "The POWs were all sent out to do work," said Kingland. "Inside the 1940s house, it probably shows that they like working with a farm family. They eat meals with them and everything." Kingland noted that local chiropractor Jim Brockhone took a small role in the movie as Grandpa Joe, and Brockhone was dressed for the part on October 31st. Gary and Barb Ludwig of Forest City also were donating use of their Model T for upcoming filming in Whitmore, he added. In addition, John Hilsland of Leland donated use of his blue Studebaker pickup truck with wood rails that he had handcrafted. The rails feature the work of renowned area artist Andy Sinwell, with a large tree and Mighty Oaks Farm stenciling on each side. It references Hillland's rural Leland family farm, formerly the Orville and Elvina Bowman acreage and homestead, in a 1951 Studebaker, but the look of it really isn't any different than the 1940s, Hillsland said. Movie producers were so enamored with his truck that they asked to use it not just for Forest City filming, but also some primary scenes in Algona in mid-November, with Hillsland slated to be shown on camera during filming. Ron Holland of Forest City donated the use of his large 1945 Hudson pickup truck. An individual from Burt offered a 1940 Chevy pickup. Carl Lind of Albert City donated the use of a 1942 Ford GTB troop truck and 1942 Jeep GPWF, which are both military vehicles. "I'm a collector," said Lind, who is also going to be portrayed as a driver in the movie. "Jim Nelson and I have worked on these for years. It is two of 20 vehicles, and most of them are military." Nelson is from Albert Lee, Minnesota. He's a collector and military vehicle driving and filming like Lind. Jim Oldman of Heritage Park was busy coordinating with the filmmakers and contacts to arrange for needs of the movie. "It's my first time experience with a film crew," Oldman said. "There are lots of people here, both young and old. They are getting makeup, costumes, props, and scenes ready. It's a busy place." The basement of the park's heated 1890 Beaver Creek Church was chosen as a staging area. Oldman helped find items and vintage vehicles. "We started talking about a month ago of the possibilities, and they came and toured the grounds," Oldman said. "We're lending some artifacts. I understand this movie revolves around the Christmas nativity scene in some regards that Germans built and left for the city of Algona. The people of Algona, from what I've read, really got along well with the prisoners. There were some romances started. There's still a German community down there." Oldman noted that Henry A. Wallace, a farmer and businessman who served as U.S. vice president and who also founded Pioneer Hybrid, new farms and businesses were lacking labor. "Algona seemed a prime prison camp location," he added. Movie co-producer Shane Hagedorn said that the church basement was used for wardrobe, extras, holding craft and food services, planning and preparation. "It's always nice to be off set because you have to be quiet when they want quiet on the set and start rolling," he said. "This movie was originally supposed to happen about 14 years ago, but now it's here. There's a lot of preparation. We're tapping into local resources. It takes a lot of community support to make it work." Hagedorn said that this is a holiday film they hope to someday call a classic. He noted that POWs were in the camp because they didn't want to fight to the death and surrender. They were waiting to get back to families and lives. "We're looking at historical events, and we don't want people to forget this story," Hagedorn said. "This is a very factual story, and the account's real enough to live on. It's wonderful how the communities have partnered with us in this picture and helped tell the world things that they didn't know about this story and expose people's minds. Citizens of Algona have opened up homes to crew, and we've now become an extended family." Writer and supervising producer D. Perry also acts in the movie, playing Camp Commander Lodell. He said that the Algona nativity scene is important to the overall story. "These prisoners were so well treated that they wanted to do things to give back to the community," Perry said. "Prisoners worked in canneries for companies like Hormel, Hershey's Company, and Smithfield Foods, who have dug into their archives and let the production company use authentic products, including actual wrappers and print ads for products such as Spam. It's kind of about unity," Perry said. "It was not the case that all Germans were Nazis. We're excited to tell a positive story that is very pertinent to today." "The Don Tietz Foundation is one of the reasons we're here," Perry continued. "They wanted to see the story told and not forgotten, as did lots of other private investors. It should remind people of the older values, that there are not lots of differences between people." Perry said he thought initially that the 1940s house would have had to be completed with decor and accessories, but was pleasantly surprised that so much was already done that we might have to remove some. Hornus agreed, confirming crews were moving some items and not adding much. "Family scenes from the house will feature stresses of marriage, crop issues, a lack of labor, and Germans on the farm, which illustrate real fears," according to Perry, who said barrack scenes will now be filmed in Algona, with much of the camp created digitally. In other news, shooting victim pointed gun. Man testifies he thought Rittenhouse was active shooter. In Kenosha, Wisconsin, a protester and volunteer medic wounded on the streets of Kenosha by Kyle Rittenhouse testified Monday that he was pointing his own gun toward the rifle-toting Rittenhouse unintentionally, he said, when the young man shot him. Gage Gross Kreutz said that the third and final man gunned down by Rittenhouse during a night of turbulent racial justice protests in the summer of 2020 took the stand at Rittenhouse's murder trial and recommended how he drew his own pistol after the bloodshed started. "I thought the defendant was an active shooter," the 27-year-old Grosskreutz said. Asked what was going through his mind as he got closer to the 17-year-old Rittenhouse, he said, "that I was going to die." Rittenhouse shot Grosskreutz in the arm, tearing away much of his bicep, or vaporized it, as the witness put it. Rittenhouse, now 18, is on trial on charges of killing two men and wounding Grosskreutz. The one-time police youth cadet from Antioch, Illinois, had gone to Kenosha with an AR-style semi-automatic rifle and a medical kit in what he said was an effort to safeguard property from the damaging demonstrations that broke out over the shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, by a white Kenosha police officer. Under questioning from the prosecution, Grosskreutz said that he had his hands raised as he closed in on Rittenhouse and didn't intend to shoot the young man. Prosecutor Thomas Binger asked Grosskreutz why he didn't shoot first. "That's not the kind of person that I am. That's not why I was out there," he said. "It's not who I am, and definitely not somebody I would want to become." But during cross-examination, Rittenhouse defense attorney Corey Chyrafsky asked, "It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, that he fired, right?" "Correct," Grosskreutz replied. The defense also presented a photo showing Grosskreutz pointing the gun at Rittenhouse, who was on the ground with his rifle pointed up at Grosskreutz. Grosskreutz, under follow-up questioning from the prosecutor, said he did not intend to point his weapon at Rittenhouse. Prosecutors have portrayed Rittenhouse as the instigator of the violence. His lawyers have argued that he acted in self-defense. He could get life in prison if convicted of the most serious charges against him. Wisconsin self-defense law allows someone to use deadly force only if necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. The jury must decide whether Rittenhouse believed he was in such peril and whether that belief was reasonable under the circumstances. Grosskreutz said that he had gone to the protest in Kenosha to serve as a medic, wearing a hat that said paramedic, and carrying medical supplies in addition to a loaded pistol. He said his permit to carry a concealed weapon had expired and he didn't have a valid one that night. "I believe in the Second Amendment. I'm for people's right to carry and bear arms," he said, explaining why he was armed. "And that night was no different than any other day. It's key, phone, wallet, and gun." He said he went into action after seeing Rittenhouse kill a man just feet away, the second person Rittenhouse fatally shot that night. While Grosskreutz said he never verbally threatened Rittenhouse, Giraffe, the defense attorney, said that people don't have to use words to threaten others. They can do so by their actions, like running after them down the street with a loaded firearm, Taraffsi said. On cross-examination, Taraffsi sought to portray Grosskreutz as dishonest in his description of the moments right before he was shot, with Taraffsi asserting that Grosskreutz was chasing Rittenhouse with his gun out. Grosskreutz denied he was chasing Rittenhouse. Jarosi said also that Grosskreutz lied when he initially told multiple police officers that he dropped his weapon. In addition, Jarosi pointed to Grosskreutz's lawsuit against the city of Kenosha, in which he alleges police enabled the violence by allowing an armed militia to have the run of the streets during the demonstration. "If Mr. Rittenhouse is convicted, your chance of getting $10 million is better, right?" Jarofsky said. Jarofsky also asked Grosskreutz if he told his former roommate that his only regret was not killing the kid and hesitating to pull the gun before emptying the entire mag into him. Grosskreutz denied saying that. At the defense table, Rittenhouse took detailed notes. When the witness spoke about the moment he was shot, Grosskreutz, who was trained as a paramedic, testified that he volunteered as a medic at protests in Milwaukee in the days after George Floyd died under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer in May of 2020. Grosskreutz said that he attended around 75 protests before the night he was shot, offering help to anyone needing medical attention. He said he provided medical assistance to about 10 other people that night in Kenosha. While Rittenhouse is white, as were those he shot, the case has stirred furious debate about the racial unrest that erupted around the U.S. that summer, as well as about vigilantism and the right to bear arms. And in other news, G8 seeks rezoning approval from city. Mason City's Planning and Zoning Commission will hold a public hearing on Tuesday regarding a rezoning request from one of Mason City's more infamous developers, Philip Choder, whose G8 development is in the midst of a lawsuit against the city for breach of contract, is requesting a zoning change for 7 parcels he owns on the corner of Highways 122 and 65 South. Choder did not return a phone call for comment. The properties on the northeast corner of the intersection are empty and have been for years. The old Mechanical Air building was located at the northeast corner of the lots. Choder seeks to change the zoning from Z4 multi-use to Z5 central business. The purpose of the Z5 central business zoning district is to provide for higher density multi-story mixed-use buildings that accommodate a variety of retail, entertainment, business and personal service, office lodging, residential, and civic functions supported by public squares, plazas, and many parks within a walkable, interconnected grid of landscape streets with sidewalks. Buildings must be at least 2 stories and may be as high as 10 stories. To preserve a walkable form, buildings are expected to be built up to the front and side lot lines. A maximum 5 feet in the front yard is allowed, according to city planning documents. The biggest changes for the property owner are that there would be no longer be any setback or parking requirements with Z5 zoning, according to the city's director of development services, Stephen Van Steenhuis. However, unlike the city's downtown, which is mostly zoned Z5, there is no nearby public parking lots. The nearest public parking lot is at the northwest corner of 6th Street Southwest and South Federal Avenue, and it contains 27 spaces, according to the city. It is at least 80 to 90 feet away from Choder's land using the closest route and requires crossing 2 major highways. The change is subject to the city's council's approval and a completed rezoning agreement, which the city and G8 are working on. Van Steenhuis said, parking requirements would be included in that agreement. G8 also requested the city vacate the alley that runs north-south through 6 of the 7 plots. But the city is waiting on development plans from G8 before addressing that request. The commission's meeting is at 7 p.m. Tuesday in the second floor conference room, City Hall, 10th First Street Northwest. In November 2018, Choder and G8 Development filed suit against the city for alleged breach of a contract after the city served the San Diego-based developer with a notice of default for not providing full financing plans to the Iowa Economic Development Authority. A trial has been tentatively set for January 10th, 2022. And in other news, weird weather, but bumper crops. Iowa and the country could be headed for record corn yields, despite uneven weather throughout the year, state agriculture and climate experts said. Iowa corn is forecast at 2.5 billion bushels, averaging 201 bushels an acre, which is an increase of 24 bushels per acre over last year, according to the latest information from the Federal Agriculture Development, or rather the Agricultural Department. It seems to be getting bigger every time we look at it. When we're looking nationwide, you're talking about the largest production we've ever seen, Chad Hart, a professor of agricultural economics, said during taping for last weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. So we are talking massive corn crop. Hart said soybeans appear headed for similarly big yields. Soybeans in Iowa are forecast at 611 million bushels at an average of 61 bushels per acre, up 7 bushels per acre from last year, according to federal information. And this impending bumper crop is on its way despite a year that saw severe drought conditions throughout much of Iowa for much of the summer, then persistent rains that led to one of the wettest Octobers on record. It has been a roller coaster, Dr. Justin Gilson, the state climatologist, said during Friday taping. We have been in a structural drought since May of 2020, and we've had ebb and flow. We've had heat waves. We've had cold weather outbreaks. We've had very dry conditions. So it is remarkable that we had the 10th wettest October on record really supplied us with additional subsoil moisture for next growing season. But those timely rainfalls during the growing season really held the crop on, and the yields look great. Hart said that the proliferation of hybrid corn options has helped protect crops from the kind of fluctuating weather that Iowa experienced this year. What we have done over the past 40, 50, even 60 years with these hybrids is we have developed hybrids that are more tolerant of a wider range of weather conditions, and those changes are definitely paying off as we look out there, Hart said. Have you got a tip that you'd like to share? We're committed to reporting stories that help our readers connect with their community, especially breaking news and matters of public safety. If you see news we should report, please consider becoming a part of North Iowa's local journalism efforts. Starting today, the Globe Gazette has developed a faster, easier way for you to submit a news tip or story idea. You'll find a new link on our website's navigation menu labeled News Tip. Tapping that link from your smartphone, tablet, or computer launches a short form that allows you to send news tips or story ideas directly to our editors. The news tip form requires you to submit a phone number and an email address. We will not publish that information, but it will help our editors verify the news tip or seek additional information. News tips cannot be submitted anonymously. Also, we cannot guarantee news coverage on every tip or story idea. The news tip feature is not for press releases, letters to the editor, obituaries, or advertising. Please use the normal channels for that content. Also, readers may continue to contact journalists directly by phone or email. News tip is just an additional way for you to communicate with us. And today in history, on November 9th, 1938, Nazis looted and burned synagogues, as well as Jewish-owned stores, and houses in Germany, in Austria, in a pogrom or deliberate persecution that became known as Kristallnacht. On this date, in 1620, the passengers and crew of the Mayflower sighted Cape Cod. In 1872, fire destroyed nearly 800 buildings in Boston. In 1918, it was announced that Germany's Kaiser Wilhelm II would abdicate. He then fled to the Netherlands. In 1935, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis and other labor leaders formed the Committee for Industrial Organization, later renamed the Congress of Industrial Organizations. In 1953, Welsh author-poet Dylan Thomas died in New York at age 39. In 1965, the Great Northeast Blackout began as a series of power failures lasting up to 13 and a half hours, leaving 30 million people in seven states and part of Canada without electricity. In 1970, former French President Charles de Gaulle died at the age of 79. And finally, in 1976, the UN General Assembly approved resolutions condemning apartheid in South Africa, including one characterizing the white-ruled government as illegitimate. And briefly, in some other news items, Adele Mann wins $25,000 Lucky for Life lottery game. A central Iowa man who has won $25,000 a year for life admits he carried the winning lottery ticket in his wallet for a couple of weeks before he realized he had hit big. Michael Mickey Pites, 37, of Adele, claimed his prize in the October 13th Lucky for Life game on Thursday at Iowa Lottery headquarters in Clive. Meanwhile, lottery officials said that Iowa had its 13th big winner in the game since it debuted in the state in January 2016 when someone bought a winning Lucky for Life ticket at a Cedar Rapids convenience store worth $25,000 a year for life in Thursday night's drawing. The winning ticket was bought at Casey's at 641 Edgewood Road Northwest in Cedar Rapids. And briefly, part of 2nd Street Northwest to close. Parts of 2nd Northwest in Mason City will be closed for the next 2 weeks. A contractor performing masonry work will shut down 2nd Street Northwest from Federal Avenue and Enterprise Alley starting Tuesday, November 9th. The city urges drivers to find an alternate route. And nationally, the U.S. fully reopens its borders. Travelers can come and go with proof of vaccine negative test. In San Diego, the U.S. fully reopened its borders with Mexico and Canada on Monday and lifted restrictions on travel that covered most of Europe, setting the stage for emotional reunions nearly 2 years in the making and providing a boost for the travel industry decimated by the pandemic. The restrictions, among the most severe in U.S. history, kept families apart, including spouses who have not been able to hug in months, grandparents whose grandchildren doubled in age since they last saw them, and uncles and aunts who have not met nieces and nephews who are now toddlers. Lines moved quickly Monday morning at San Diego's border with Mexico, the busiest crossing in the U.S., despite the added checks for vaccinations required to enter the country. The new rules also lifted restrictions on air travel from some countries dating back the early days of the pandemic, as long as the travelers have proof of vaccination and a negative COVID-19 test. American citizens and permanent residents were also allowed to enter the U.S., but the travel bans grounded tourists, thwarted business travelers, and often separated families. On the U.S. borders with Mexico and Canada, where traveling back and forth was a way of life before the pandemic, the reopening brought relief. Malls, restaurants, and shops in the U.S. border towns have been devastated by the lack of visitors from Mexico. San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria, flanked by U.S. and Mexican officials at a celebratory news conference at the San Ysidro crossing, said the economic losses were hefty and the cutting of family ties immeasurable. Tijuana Mayor Montserrat Caballero called it a reunion between neighbor countries. Retail sales in San Ysidro on California's border with Mexico fell about 75%. From pre-COVID levels, forcing nearly 300 businesses to close. Wow, We can finally breathe, Jason Wells, executive director of the San Ysidro Chamber of Commerce, said before dozens of cameras. Along Canada's boundary, cross-border hockey rivalries were upended. Churches that had members on both sides of the border were suddenly cut off from each other. But on Monday, border traffic quickly returned. You're listening to the reading of the Globe Gazette for November 9th, 2021 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Doris Bauman, age 89, of Mason City, passed away on Friday, November 5th, at the Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, November 10th, 2021, at the Faith Baptist Church at 1807 Kentucky Avenue, with Pastor Dave Callison officiating. Services will be live-streamed on the Major Erickson Funeral Home Facebook page. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service. Interment will be held at a later date in the Elmwood St. Joseph Cemeteries. Memorials may be directed to the family of Doris Bauman. Online condolences may also be left for the family at www.majorericksonfuneralhome.com. Arrangements are being held by Major Erickson Funeral Home at 111 North Pennsylvania Avenue in Mason City. The telephone number for them is area code 641-423-0924. Rhonda Coop, age 45, of Rockwell, passed away at her home on Sunday, November 7th, 2021. Funeral arrangements for Rhonda are incomplete at this time with Ewing Funeral Home at 111 Luke's Lane South at Belmont, and they can be contacted at area code 641-444-3248. Calvin Carl Kramer, age 73, of Clear Lake, has died on Saturday, November 6th, at Concord Care Center in Garner. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, November 13th, at Clear Lake United Methodist Church at 508 2nd Avenue, North Clear Lake, with Reverend David Peterson officiating. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery in Mason City. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, November 12th, at Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel at 310 1st Avenue North, Clear Lake. In lieu of customary remembrances, the family is suggesting memorial contributions to the Clear Lake Booster Club. Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel is located at 310 1st Avenue in North Clear Lake, and you can also contact them at area code 641-357-2193. And Dwayne E. Sabin, age 83, passed on November 5th at his home in Urbandale, surrounded by his loving family. The family will receive friends 5 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. Friday, November 12th, at Isles Westover Chapel. A private family funeral service will be held Saturday at St. Stephen's Lutheran Church, and burial will take place at Mason City Memorial Gardens. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be made to Blank Children's Development Center under the direction of Dr. Nate Noble, Unity Point or Care Initiatives Hospice. Online condolences are also welcome, and you can do that at www.islescares.com. James A. Erb, age 80, has passed at Charles City as of November 5th. A funeral mass for Jim Erb will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, November 12th at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Charles City, with Father Tom Heathershaw officiating. Interment will be at a later date at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery in Roseville. Friends may call from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, November 11th, 2021 at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church at 106 Chapel Lane in Charles City. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to Mass on Friday. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Charles City YMCA Foundation or TLC, the Learning Center in Charles City, in honor of Jim. Hauser Weishauer Funeral Home in Charles City is assisting with arrangements. And finally, Richard Allen Morris, age 74, has passed away on November 2nd, 2021, in Grove, Oklahoma. Memorial services are scheduled for 2 p.m. November 12th at Worley Lugenbuehl Funeral Home Chapel in Grove, Oklahoma. And in some other news, Marietta, Georgia, Santa may have fewer eyes in homes this Christmas season after a Georgia judge jokingly banned the elf on the shelf. Cobb County Superior Court Chief Judge Robert Leonard posted a mock order on Twitter banishing these elves. Tired of living an elf on the shelf of tyranny, not looking forward to the elf forgetting to move and causing your kids emotional distress, I am a public servant and will take the heat for you. My gift to tired parents, Leonard tweeted Thursday. According to the holiday tradition, the elves hide in homes for weeks before Christmas and report back to Santa on who's been naughty and nice. The elf dolls are supposed to move to a different location each night. Inexplicably, elves sometimes move and don't move overnight. When those elves do not move, it leaves our children of tender years in states of extreme emotional distress, Leonard wrote in his order. He recalled a horrific incident in his own home when three children were sent to school in tears, with one child being labeled an elf murderer and accused of making the elf lose his magic. Given the risks of such emotional damage and supply chain issues caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the judge wrote that he had no choice but to banish the elves from Cobb County. He did make an allowance for parents who don't feel overwhelmed by the elf on the shelf tyranny, writing in his tweet, "If you love your elf, keep your elf. No contempts." And now let's turn to sports. Departing Vase gets national acclaim. After 18 seasons at the NIACC, head cross country coach Curtis Vase will be stepping down from the position at the end of this year. But before he leaves collegiate athletics fully, Vase will be honored nationally for his success and hard work. The NJCAA announced that Vase would be inducted into the NJCAA Cross Country and Track Field Coaches Association Hall of Fame as part of the class of 2021 to 2022. "I would have never guessed in a million years," Vase said. "It's a great feeling to know that the committee thought so highly of me to vote me into this." Since Vase started the Trojan cross-country program in 2004, NIACC has been a pillar of success in the NJCAA. Former NIACC athletic director Dan Mason said in his recommendation letter that Vase was incredibly deserving and created a culture of excellence. "Coach Vase is international in his training methods and is passionate about the student development piece for every member of his program," Mason said. The cross-country teams, both the men's and women's teams, routinely excel in the academic arena and have represented all of us in a positive fashion on our campus and within our community. And in other sports, fist-pumping Mohawk girls headed to tourney. Mason City qualifies individuals in 8 of 12 state events. Over a decade ago, one of head coach Steve Hugo's athletes on the Mason City girls swimming team got him a shirt that said fist pumping like champs. Up until Saturday, he hadn't worn the shirt since that season. But the regional girls swimming met at Ankeny was an important one for the Mohawks. I broke it out for this meet, and I put it on after not wearing it for 10 to 12 years, Hugo said. There were lots of fist-pumping champs for Mason City at the meet this weekend. Mason City had plenty of reason to celebrate on Saturday. The Mohawks finished third out of six teams with 314 points. Along the way, the team qualified athletes in eight out of the 12 different events at the meet. It was one of the best regional meets that Hugo has ever been a part of. Saturday's meet was probably one of the biggest meets in time cuts in Mason City swimming history, Hugo said. There were some huge ones. Junior Rosa Monarch got things started in the diving meet on Thursday. She finished third overall with a final score of 381.15. In her second year of diving, Monarch qualified for the state meet once again, which Hugo says the rest of the team was excited about. She's seated now at 19th, Hugo said. Top 16 score, so she's going to really have to hit her top eight dives and move through the prelims and the semifinals and get into the final 16. Even if she's 16th, she's going to score a point for the team. The best individual performer on Saturday was sophomore Aspen Cole, who won the 200-yard IM in 2 minutes, 12.80 seconds. She was the only event winner for the Mohawks. Earlier this season, she had her sights set on the state meet. My goal is to make the A final, which is top eight, Cole said. I made the B final last year, which is 9-16. So one of my goals is to make the A final in the 200 IM. Cole also qualified for a state in three other events. She was third in the 100-yard breaststroke, 1 minute 8.47 seconds, while racing on the 400-yard freestyle relay and the 200-yard IM medley relay. The team of Cole, sophomore Grace Hare, and juniors Jenna Brown and Marie Mantranach placed third in the 400-yard relay, 3.46.83 seconds, while the team of Cole, Hare, junior Taylor Halverson, and senior Kate Edgerton placed third in the 200 IM medley at 1 minute 51.88 seconds. The Mohawks also managed to qualify their 200-yard freestyle relay team of Mantranach, Halverson, Edgerton, and Brown, which finished in fourth with a time of 1 minute 44.31 seconds. Mason City loaded up on its qualifiers in the 100-yard breaststroke. Outside of Cole, both Taylor Halverson, fifth at 1 minute and 9.96 seconds, and freshman Lauren Halverson, eighth at 1 minute and 11.18 seconds, qualified for the state meet. Hare rounded out the qualifiers by doubling up the individual events, qualifying in the 100-yard backstroke, fourth at 1 minute 40 seconds, and the 500-yard freestyle at 5 minutes 26.35 seconds. Everyone seemed to give a little extra at this meet, Hugo said. Mason City will compete in the diving and individual swimming preliminary heats at 11 a.m. on Friday at Marshalltown. Saturday at 12 p.m. is the finals for the individual events and relays. Before the meet, Hugo has a message for his team. Mostly remember what you did last Saturday and figure out any tiny mistakes or part of your race where maybe you backed off a little bit, Hugo said. Then really give it 100% at the state's swimming meet. And let's take a look at college football here in Iowa. Padilla listed as Hawkeyes starter versus Gophers. Petrus nursing a shoulder injury will not dress. For the first time in 18 games, Spencer Petras is not listed as the Iowa football team's starting quarterback on the Hawkeye depth chart. The shoulder injury that forced Petras off the field late in the first quarter of the last weekend's 17-12 victory at Northwestern has also kept him off the depth chart for Saturday's game with Minnesota. Alex Padilla, who led Iowa on its three scoring drives in the win over the Wildcats, is listed as Iowa's first-team quarterback for the 2:30 p.m. battle for Floyd of Rosedale at Kinnick Stadium. A six-foot-one sophomore from Jeanwood Village, Colorado, Padilla completed 18 of 28 passes for 172 yards last weekend. He orchestrated touchdown drives of 58 and 83 yards during Iowa's first two offensive series after Petras excited after completing just two of the four passes for 4 yards. Coach Kirk Ferentz said Petras' passes lacked zip, showing signs of lingering issues created by a shoulder injury that occurred late in the fourth quarter of an October 30th game at Wisconsin. Petras had seen only limited work in practice prior to the Northwestern game, but Ferentz felt he was healthy enough to compete following a Friday workout. Ferentz said coaches noticed the lack of velocity in Petras' passes as he warmed up Saturday, then opted to replace the quarterback who has led Iowa to a 13-4 record over the past two seasons as a starter. Padilla has taken snaps in 5 games this season, completing 22 of 42 passes for 233 yards. Deuce Hogan is listed as the second-team quarterback for the matchup against the Golden Gophers, the redshirt freshman's first appearance on the depth chart in his career. The 6-4 native of Southlake, Texas, has played in 1 game for Iowa this season. He completed the only pass he attempted in the Hawkeyes' 51-14 win at Maryland for a 2-yard gain. The only other change, on the Iowa depth charts this week is on the offensive line, where injured redshirt freshman Mason Richmond, a starter in each game of the Hawkeyes' 7-2 season, is absent after suffering an injury in the Northwestern game. Jack Plume, a starter the past 2 games at right tackle, is listed as the Hawkeyes' projected starter at left tackle this week, with Nick DeJong returning to the right tackle spot he started at for Iowa's first 7 games. And in college women's basketball, busy opening week awaits Hawkeyes. At a season filled with a lofty expectation opens, the Iowa women's basketball team is hoping for a quick start. The 9th-ranked Hawkeyes have little choice. Iowa begins the season by playing 3 games in 6 days, an early test of sorts beginning with a 6 p.m. game Tuesday against New Hampshire. A matchup with Samford follows at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday before the Hawkeyes face their first road test with a 2 p.m. game Sunday at Northern Iowa. It's a busy week, Iowa coach Lisa Bluder said. It won't be easy because there will not be a lot of time to prep for any of these games. And going to UNI on Sunday, that's always a tough place for us to play and always a hard game. But before even thinking about the first of its in-state matchups, the Hawkeyes are concerning themselves with setting a tone during their first regular season games in front of fans at Carver Hawkeye Arena in 2 years. It's going to be great to get back to having a home court advantage, junior McKenna Warnock said. Our fans add a lot to the game. I think we really realized that last year when we had to bring our own energy. Both teams Iowa hosts this week feature veteran lineups. Like the Hawkeyes, New Hampshire returns all five starters from last season, and Samford has four starters back. I think our players are looking forward to getting out and competing against somebody else, Bluder said. We need to play games and see where we're at. Iowa will have a size advantage in its opener against a team that finished 5-15 a year ago, and Bluder hopes that leads to a strong start from Monica Cesinano in the post. The nation's top shooter a year ago at 66.8% from the field returns after averaging 19.3 points per game last season as the inside complement to the 26.6 points per game scored by Caitlin Clark on the outside, with center Sharon Goodson sidelined for the season with an ACL tear, senior Logan Cook and freshman Addison O'Grady, while backup Cesinano and Bluder would like to get both some minutes early in the season. We have a height advantage and we need to use it, Bluder said. We need to get the ball inside and make the most of it. And in college football, Iowa State, Uwazirike McDonald records 2.5 sacks each in win against Texas. Iowa State's defensive lines looked unstoppable on Saturday against Texas. The line combined for 5 sacks in the Cyclones' 30-7 win over the Longhorns. All 5 of those sacks came from 2 players, too. Will McDonald and Enyi Uwazirike each had 2.5 sacks, and both were in the Texas backfield often. We just had to go after their line, McDonald said, who now owns Iowa State's career sacks record with 26.5 sacks. We didn't do so well last week, and we didn't get any pressure at all. We didn't do what we were needing to do, so we needed to step up as a defensive line to get pressures and sacks. What made the performance even more impressive was Iowa State didn't send many exotic looks or blitzes. The Cyclones sent their normal 3-man rush, but Texas made the crucial error of trying to block McDonald one-on-one. Figuring out who to double-team is honestly a problem our defense presents right now, McDonald said. I don't know how teams are going to try and figure it out, but they're going to have to try and stop one of us, and then it'll depend on the other person to get back there. McDonald and Uwazirike might have been the only ones to get sacks, but the rest of the line played well, too. Returning from injury, defensive tackle J.R. Singleton forced a Bijan Robinson fumble that was recovered by Jake Hummel. Zach Peterson had 3 tackles. Blake Peterson had 2 tackles, as did Tyler Onyedim. I think our D-line has played to a standard of excellence all year, Campbell said. I think Anye has been phenomenal. He was incredible again tonight. Isaiah Lee is playing against football for this team. He was incredible for us tonight. We just talked about Will, and he was huge for us. Young players are getting more time. What would Iowa State fans have said if you had told them a decade ago that the Cyclones would play their backups in an easy win against Texas? That was the reality on Saturday. Campbell started playing guys lower down on the depth chart midway through the fourth quarter. The freshman, Deion Sillis, was in it at running back. Peterson and Onyedim played a lot of snaps in the fourth quarter, and walk-on linebacker Kendall Jackson got significant playing time. What's really rewarding for me is, yes, some of our A players played A football, Campbell said. But man, a guy like Blake Peterson, who has been a warrior in trying to get better, he was in on some critical movements, or moments rather, and played phenomenal for us. Kendall Jackson is a young man that walked on here and has been a really good special teams player for us. He played some meaningful snaps tonight and played really well at the WILL linebacker. An injury was reported after missing last game due to injury. Linebacker Mike Rose returned to the lineup. He didn't play as much as he normally does, but he still had 5 tackles, which was the second most on Iowa State's team. "Yeah, I think Mike's doing good," Campbell said. "We were being cautious and bringing him back slowly. It was huge for him to get through the game and feel good. I think he'll continue to progress." During the game, right tackle Derek Schwager went out with an injury, but he was able to return later in the game, and Campbell said that Schwager will be good to go moving forward. And that does it for today's reading of the Globe Gazette for November 9th, 2021. I'm your reader, Peter Welch. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.